Welcome to the Reimagining Motherhood podcast. I'm your host, Chelsea Robinson, mattress-centric feminist psychotherapist, matrescence educator, creator of the Mattress-Centric Way, and founder of Mama's Modern Village. My hope is that these conversations with scholars, researchers, activists, and changemakers leave you feeling inspired and empowered, reflective and curious, whether you are a mother yourself or someone who supports them professionally. May you gain the tools, knowledge, and vocabulary you need to begin putting your experience into words, externalizing the motherhood shoulds we so often make our own, and begin to reimagine motherhood, not just for yourself, but for all mothers everywhere. Disclaimer, this podcast is not intended to be used as clinical advice, simply educational in nature. Now, let's do this. Welcome to the Reimagining Motherhood podcast. Dr. Andrea O'Reilly is internationally recognized as the founder of Motherhood Studies and its subfield Maternal Theory, and creator of Mattress-Centric Feminism, a feminism for and about mothers, and Matricritics, a literary theory and practice for a reading of mother-focused texts. In spring 2024, a collection of her essays, In Mother Words, Writings on Mothering and Motherhood, will be published, and in fall of 2024, her next edited book, The Mother Wave, Theorizing, Enacting, and Representing Mattress-Centric Feminism, will be published. If you are interested in learning more about the virtual book club offered by Dr. O'Reilly, or purchasing any of her books or resources on any of these incredible topics that are covered in our podcast, make sure you check the show notes below. I am so excited to kick off the Reimagining Motherhood podcast with someone who is a dear friend and mentor of mine, someone who I found randomly one night when I was scrolling through Google trying to better understand this experience of motherhood that not only I was experiencing, but so many of my peers, my friends, and the women and mothers that I support in my practice were experiencing too. It led me into academic journals, but finally I found her, Dr. Andrea O'Reilly, the founder of Mattress-Centric Feminism and the whole field of motherhood studies. And once I came across her work, my whole world expanded personally and professionally. And now she's here today to launch this incredible podcast, which truly is my hope that this becomes a vault of all of this knowledge and wisdom and story and history that is ours for reflection, for activism, that is ours for the taking, truly. So whether you are a mother, whether you are a professional that works and supports mothers, or you are a partner who has come across or been sent this podcast, this is meant to be a tool, a resource, a support for you, no matter where you are on your motherhood journey. So without further ado, I am excited to bring to you the very first episode of the Reimagining Motherhood podcast with Dr. Andrea O'Reilly. All right. Well, hello and welcome to the Reimagining Motherhood podcast. I am so profoundly grateful and truly like very excited and giddy to be welcoming you, Dr. Andrea O'Reilly, as the first and foremost episode on this podcast. I feel, again, so profoundly grateful for all of your contributions to this space, and I stand on your shoulders. So thank you for being here.
And thank you for having me.
Of course. Okay. So as we begin, I would love if you don't mind sharing with us a little bit of how you came into this space. What made you you?
That's a question I'm often asked. And as many times as I've answered it, I still kind of pause and you know, maybe even catch my breath. As I think many scholars, activists, we come to the work we do, I think we're driven by a passion, by necessity. And for me, like so many others, that is how I found myself in this space now, soon to be 40 years later. And I say that because, as I've shared in my interviews and in several of my publications, that I came to motherhood quite unplanned, quite unexpected. I was in my fourth year, my honors BA, you know, majoring in women's studies and literature, and I was going to do a master's degree and have this great career. And I was dating this okay guy. And I thought, okay, my life is going to go as planned. Well, in November of that year, 1982, I wasn't just late, I was pregnant. So it was like, whoa, you know, I'm adamantly pro-choice. Now, abortion wasn't easily accessed at that point in Canada. You could get it, but there was committees you had to go through. So, but, you know, I kind of went back and went to my partner and said, guess what? I'm pregnant. What do we do? And it was like, I don't know. What do we do? And after a lot of soul searching, I decided I wanted to have the baby. And interesting, most people said I shouldn't have had the baby. And I find that an interesting, which certainly other people have written and spoken on, because as a good girl, I actually probably should have had an abortion because I had my life ahead of me. As a good white middle-class girl, I should forego motherhood till the appropriate time and concentrate on my career, you know, get married and, you know, follow the trajectory that was expected of me. I didn't. I took a different script, if you will. So a long, very long story short, we ended up, you know, deciding to have the baby. My partner and I moved in 6 weeks later to university housing. My partner and I are still together 43 years later. We never married. We're common law. And we had our son in July 1984, so soon to be 40 years from now. And I guess I share that story because it brought me to feminism. I was always a feminist, but boy, motherhood radicalized me, politicized me, transformed me. 100% unequivocally, emphatically, and most pointedly for the work that I do is I didn't know how invisibilized motherhood had been. I didn't see it till I'd become a mother. I had taken up to that point 20 courses in literature and health and work and public policy and film. You think we would have talked about motherhood in a women's studies degree? It hadn't really been mentioned. And if it had been mentioned, it was in passing or even more worse, perhaps disparagingly, motherhood's oppressive, don't do it. If you're a good feminist, you know, free yourself from that, find the boys and have a great career, you know, crudely put, but I think that was the message. So that really shocked me, but I didn't see its invisibilization until I became a mother. That shocked me as well. So I said, why isn't it there? But why didn't I even see that it wasn't there? So that became, I suppose, my life mission. I just thought we need to talk about motherhood. We need to teach it and study it as deserving of academic inquiry as we would any other topic. So, you know, my mission began. I then started a master's degree in literature. I went on to do a PhD. I went on to have two more children, both also unplanned. I started my PhD with my son 2 years old and 6 months pregnant with my first daughter. Certainly not something I would advise to do, right? To start a PhD with a 2-year-old and pregnant because there was no maternity leave. So I was back in the hospital. My daughter was 2 days, well, 4 days old, 2 days out of hospital. So that brought me to here. And so from that, I developed the first course on motherhood in 1990, first course in North America. And then several years later, as I'm finishing my PhD, I thought, you know, we need to have a conference on this. So I had a conference on this, which initially was going to be like an afternoon tea and ended up being a conference with 200 people from around the world. That led to, I think we need an organization to support motherhood scholarship, to bring us together as activists and scholars. So in 1998, I formed the Association for Research on Motherhood, which became the Motherhood Initiative. And that ran from 97 to 2020, where it was passed off to someone else who now does that work. And then I started a journal in 99 and then a feminist press in 2006. So it was just driven by necessity. You know, I created the course, the journal, the press, the scholarship that I needed that I didn't have when I became a mother so young, you know, at the age of 23. So, it's just been, a politics of necessity.
Oh, my goodness. Thank you so much for sharing your journey with me. I see myself reflected in different aspects of your story, but in something that just speaks, I think, to so many mothers. It does seem the work of mothering seems so invisible until we become mothers ourselves. And then we see it and we feel it deep in our bones. And the impact of that does drive us, some of us, most of us probably, to want to work towards and activate change. Mm-hmm. Because this is work. No yes. question. Being a mother is work. And I am so grateful that you have dedicated your life, both personally and professionally, to creating spaces where mothers are the forefront of theory, of conferences, of scholarship. It's just necessary. And truthfully, I didn't know about you or your work or any of this in any of my clinical training. And I think that was so surprising for me, was that there was this whole entire discipline rich with scholarship and theory and research that now I see deeply informs my work clinically, but it was missing. It was, it was just, again, invisible to my trainings. And so that is definitely my hope, is that we continue to bring you and your work and all the many scholars, you know, that are now in this space, and kind of bridge that so that we share this wealth and knowledge across.
Yeah, I think your point is so important and so well taken. You know, it is, you know, despite we've been doing this work now, I mean, I'm on the shoulders of other four mothers like Adrienne Rich, Sarah Ruddock, Patricia Collins. But we've been doing this work, you know, certainly for 50 years, but in a sustained way, at least since the mid 90s. So coming up to 30 years plus, and I still hear, you know, I get an email maybe every week, not a call, it used to be phone calls, you know, just discovered this, I need to talk to you type of thing. Oh my goodness, why didn't I know this? And it's very frustrating. It really is. It's because how do we break through? How do we get, you know, we've created the research. That was the first big, you know, hurdle, which I think we've done. It's there. I mean, of course, much more needs to be done and will continue to be done. Our Demeter Press publishes, you know, 12 to 15 titles a year, and we've got them queued up to 2028, I think. So lots more research in the pipeline and more needs to be done. But I think we can still speak with confidence about a discipline of motherhood studies or field of maternal theory. We can say that with, I think, full confidence. So why is this not in the hands of so many people? I think part of it is, it's, as you say, a disinterest in motherhood. We devalue motherhood, invisibilize it. So is it any surprise we devalue and invisibilize scholarship on motherhood, right? So it seems so obvious that we don't see motherhood worthy of discussion or analysis, let alone scholarship. It's just something women do, right? It's instinctual. It's natural. It's not important. It's not work. So if we think that, we're certainly not going to think that scholarship on motherhood is valuable either. So that's been a really uphill battle. Sense. It really has been. I have been, you know, fighting this, I guess, 40 years now. And I've been, you know, almost, I wouldn't say weekly anymore, but maybe every other week. I'm still, less common than 30 years ago, 20 years ago, but still I'm defending motherhood as a discipline that is legitimate, worthy, rigorous, important, and so forth. Other disciplines don't have to defend themselves like this. And they are canonized. They are in the classrooms. They are in, you know, clinical training. They are in, you know, graduate programs. We're there, but you got to go looking for us in a way that you should not.
That's for sure. I agree. I mean, that's what I had to do. Like, who would have thought that, you know, I would have ever ordered an academic journal online to read for fun, but that's how I found you. I knew that, you know, I really deeply value the theory of matrescence and the concept of, you know, the huge transformation of a woman becoming a mother, but in supporting them through that lens, I felt something was missing. And it was missing the greater context that we don't just become a mother isolated on an island. We become a mother within this socially and culturally, politically, et cetera, constructed institution of motherhood. And that deeply informs our experience of what it means to be a mother and the work of mothering. And it just opened my mind, blew my mind. And I was like, I have to get more of this, which is how I found you. And my life has forever been changed. So again, just so much gratitude for what you've cultivated and created here. And
but you make a good point. I mean, I think part of the problem too is, you know, it's partially our fault as academics. We really have less so our organization, Motherhood Initiative. We did really make an effort in our 20 conferences, 20 years, I should say, of conferences. We did over 50 conferences, mainly in Canada, US, but we were in Italy, we were in Greece, we were in Ireland, we were in, you know, Barbados. You know, we did do a lot of conferences outside sort of the North American space. And we really did encourage activists to come, you know, artists to come, social practitioners to come. And they did. And we would have had 50 to 150 people at each conference. So, you know, there was some movement, but it just feels, you know, as we made this progress, you know, we were three steps back every time, right? And of course, it comes to, like every feminist organization, not to be crude, it comes down to money. You know, we are a nonprofit organization, Demeter Press. We have no funding. We basically get this very, very, very small grant that we basically have to sell our soul to the devil to every year to get it. I'm paying an enormous amount of money, you know, and you know, counting invoices to get the grant. So yeah, but ask any feminist organization and they'll share the same story. We don't have the money to do, you know, social media advertising. We don't have the money to hire staff. We don't have the money to be speaking at conferences or to be putting leaflets in various brochures. So I think that's, you know, not to put too crude a point on it, but that is a big part of the limitation. We're mothers, we're poor, right? We're, you know, so it's not like an organization where a donor, you know, bequeaths, you know, $1 million or $10 million for a medical school, right? So we don't have a room of our own, to use Virginia Woolf's concept. We might have a theory of our own, a discipline of our own, a community of our own, a belief in what we do as important of our own. But that, I think, is really the missing piece. So, I, you know, we struggle with that. And I will continue to struggle with that, as is, will every feminist organization. But I think part of the work that you're doing is so important, that you're disseminating this, even with the limitations of revenue. You're getting it into the hands of women who really need this. We don't do this work. Oh, speak to each other. We do this work to make social change. At least I do, right? I want women's lives as mothers to be better. I want to understand why they're oppressed. I want to know why mothers are oppressed. What created this? How did we get here? What causes it? Who benefits from our oppression? How do we change it? What is the impact of this on mothers? How can we mobilize to change it? Can we change it? You know, what do we need to do? I mean, I could list 50 questions, and as you do. But we can only answer those questions through research and speaking to mothers. So we need both. We need the research, but we need to talk to mothers and hear their stories about how they're living patriarchal motherhood, how it's oppressing them, how they're managing, how they're trying to change it, what are the costs to them, and to their children, and to their families, and to the community, and how do we envision a better way of doing this? Because I believe fundamentally there is a better way of doing this, of raising children and caring for each other, and to do motherhood in a very empowered way rather than in such a self-limiting, oppressive way.
You have just made so many important points in what you've shared. I'm wondering if, like, for simply for vocabulary's sake, if I can ask you to define some of the terms that you've used, because I think education is an essential aspect of this effort in consciousness raising. So can we start? I just heard you say patriarchal motherhood. Do you mind defining that for those that are listening?
Yes. Yes. I will say one thing, as we mentioned previously before the podcast started, I'm going to do a plug for my most recent book. I have published over 35 books. And I've edited some, and I've authored, I edited most, authored three, and I kept getting asked, you know, where can I find your explanation of patriarchal motherhood? Where can I understand what you mean by empowered mothering? What the heck do you mean by feminist mother lines? You know, why is, you know, what is the history of normative motherhood? So I get asked that a fair bit, and I say, well, it's in chapter four of that book I published in 2009, or that's in the one I did in 2018. So this year, somewhat reluctantly, I have published a collection of my essays, which will actually be uploaded to the printers on Friday. So 24 hours from now, give or take, maybe 48. And it's a collection of my essays, 25 in total, what I've written from 2009 to 2024. It's 535 pages long. And it basically, you know, will cover what we're talking about this interview and, many, many other topics. And I say all that because you're right. I mean, to answer that question in a sentence is challenging. It's not impossible, but I will do my best. But again, you know, that's why I think research is so important, because people who are interested can go, okay, I kind of got that, but I think I need to read a bit more. And I really commit myself in most places, and I try to write in very accessible language. I also have a PhD in English. So how I theorize is I tell stories. So when I'm talking in my writing or in my teaching, and I'm really dealing with a difficult concept, I tell a story about my own mothering, right? So I will tell you a story to illustrate patriarchal motherhood. So patriarchal motherhood, which is actually Adrienne Rich's term, for which we'll be forever indebted, Her book of Woman Born came out in 1976. And she made the crucial distinction between the motherhood as institution and mothering as experience. And that might sound a bit weighty, but it's actually quite straightforward. She argues that the institution is how women are told to mother. It is the rules, the regulations, the expectations that dictate who is a good mother. And that is all pervasive, you know, when she should become a mother, how many children should she have? How should she raise those children? Under which conditions should she raise them? And generally the good mother under patriarchal motherhood in the West, well, we know who she is, right? She's generally white, middle class, heterosexual, able-bodied, married to a man, has two children that are biologically related to her. She, you know, probably lives in suburbia with the, you know, the SVU. She puts her children's lives at the before hers. They are the center of her meaning. She might have to work today. Ideally, she's a stay-at-home mom, but we realize, you know, the realities of economics. So we might allow this ideal good mother to work. But if she does, it should be only work. It should not be a career. And, you know, and it should always come secondary to her children. So that's patriarchal motherhood, or sometimes called normative motherhood. And it is not how we mother. It's how we're told to mother. It's this idealization of motherhood. So, and then that ideal mother, that ideal patriarchal mother also has lots of traits or characteristics. She's always happy. She's nurturing. She's empathetic. She's kind. She might be a martyr. She's selfless. She's all giving. She puts her children first. She never gets mad. She's completely composed and fulfilled in motherhood. So this is the ideal mother. And, you know, so when I teach my course, I ask people, you know, are you the ideal mother? A hand has never gone up, right? And sometimes when I said, was your mother an ideal mother? Sometimes a student will raise their hand. And I said, you mean she never got mad at you? And then they go, oh, wait a minute, maybe not. So the patriarchal motherhood is that ideal mother, how we're told to mother, how we're not just told, we're required to mother. And if we don't mother that way, we're often seen as a bad mother. We're too young, we're too poor, we're Black, we are queer, we have too many children, we don't have enough children. You know, so on and so forth. So the patriarchal motherhood is so limiting who can get to be that ideal good motherhood. So that's on that side. We need to undo that. We need to find out how it happened, where it came from. And I do that in the book I mentioned and in other writings. We look at the history of patriarchal motherhood, where it came from, what, and how did we get rid of it? But also so important, and this is the part we often forget, Adrienne Rich said there's also mothering. And mothering is the experience of mothering, of raising our children, and which Adrienne Rich said can be potentially, first of all, not oppressive, but even more so, it might even be empowering. If we could determine the ways we mother, if we could mother according to our values, if we could mother in a way which in which our work was respected and supported, if we could mother according to our beliefs and visions and aspirations and not as we're told to, then maybe mothering could be empowering. Maybe mothering doesn't require mothers to give up their whole self. Why does it? Who says so? Why do you have to give up yourself to be a good mother? It doesn't make any sense to me. I think mothers who have a strong sense of self are better mothers. So we have to, so what motherhood studies tries to do, and what I do in my writing and spend a fair bit of time in that book I mentioned, is try to imagine this empowered mothering. What does it look like? How do we get there? How do we achieve it? Is it possible? Because can we ever move from motherhood to mothering? Maybe not completely, because even as we resist normative or patriarchal motherhood, it's always forever there, right? And we might say, I don't want to do it that way, but we are so schooled in that way, it's hard even to get out of our own head. Even myself, you know, I resist patriarchal motherhood. I know it's not true. I know it's idealized. I know it's not good for me or my kids. But sometimes, particularly when they're little, many times, you know, I beat myself up because I wasn't living up to what society said I needed to. And then, you know, and I think, wait a minute, that's not good for me. It's not good for my kids. Why am I beating myself up? Right. So I don't know if I've answered that, but you're right. These terms are seems to be wieldy, but they're not. Academics just like putting, well, we lean D terms that we can then define and then we can just go back to and don't have to keep re-explaining it, if you will. Right. So, yeah, patriarchal motherhood and empowered mothering are probably the biggest concepts in motherhood studies. What's oppressive about it, what we need to do to get rid of it, change it, and then also what could it possibly look like, this empowered mothering, if women could dictate the conditions under which they raise their children.
Thank you so much for sharing more on that, those two critical concepts of motherhood studies, patriarchal motherhood and empowered mothering. I think that as we, you know, continue hopefully providing some education from this space and making it additionally more accessible to mothers, when we have words to describe our experiences, we can begin to talk about them and externalize these experiences so that it doesn't anymore feel like, oh, this is a me problem. There's something I'm missing or I'm not getting it right. We can then see that, oh, it's more so this institution of motherhood and these ideologies that I have taken on to be my own. But now yes. I can see potentially there's choice in how I yes. relate with them.
Yes, I think that's a really good point. Now, you know, never underestimate how difficult all of this is, because patriarchal motherhood is everywhere. It's in, you know, it's in our school systems and it's in our legal systems and it's literally the air we breathe. So, you know, mothers, you know, absorb those messages and judge other mothers and judge ourselves, right? We do. And but the struggle is to turn off those voices, right? To somehow mute them. To know, as you rightly, and we keep, it's not an I problem. It's a societal problem. There is nothing wrong with mothers. It is the impossible conditions under which we ask mothers to mother. It is ludicrous how we ask mothers to mother in the West. No mother should raise a child alone. And never mind in poverty and in isolation or with illness, whether it be physical or mental, with absolutely no communal support. And this became so magnified during the pandemic where, you know, it is simply not wise or prudent to ask mothers to do this. And we never did it like this before. This, you know, and I spent a lot of time in, you know, my work, as do many others. This is a very recent configuration of the family. It is 100 years old, 150. And in other cultures, they're still raising children communally with extended kin, with other mothering, communal mothering. It takes a village to raise a child. We throw that around in the West, but that's how we raise children till, you know, the middle of the 19th century. So this recent nuclear family, individualized, privatized motherhood is so recent and so ineffectual, to put it mildly. It is not working. And we need to understand that. And why are we still asking mothers to mother under impossible conditions where they're completely idealized but unsupported, where they have all the they have all the responsibility, all the blame, but no real power from which to mother? I mean, who would you ask that of anybody? To say, do all the work, you have all the blame, all the responsibility. Oh, but by the way, we're not going to do anything to help you. And then we're going to blame you for everything you did. So we have to imagine different ways of mothering, different ways of configuring family. And it's hard because we live with the nuclear family. We live, you know, with individualized, privatized values, particularly in the US. It's your problem. They're your kids. But we're not going to get out of this mess until we see children as a collective good, until we value the work of mothering and really support it in every imaginable way, not just in public policy, but in attitude and, you know, cultural views and so forth. That's my rant.
Oh, I love it.
So enraged.
No, rant
I just
on.
Get so
please.
Angry. And, you know, I had my children 40 years ago. So much. I know things are worse for mothers today with, you know, we call it, you know, an academic term, the rise of neoliberalism. That's just a fancy way of saying that governments have downloaded everything onto families now, and that we're responsible for figuring out our own problems. And we don't, it's our fault. We're supposed to be that resilient, reliable, hardworking, self-sufficient person. And if we don't make it, it's our fault. Right. And so, you know, we are in a new mess since the 80s and 90s, right? And I think things are far worse for mothers. We're expected to do way, way, way more with far, far, far less support. I mean, it was never good to be a mother in the West, but it's far harder now. The standards have gone through the roof and the support has gone to the basement, right? So women are in a no-win situation as mothers. Absolutely. So we got to do something. We as women, unfortunately, it's going to be us. Can't wait for the governments or men to suddenly become enlightened. It's unfortunately they're going to have to start, you know, demanding change and working towards that change, and hopefully having allies along the way.
I absolutely agree. There's so many different points again in what you just shared, but this idea, right? I in so many of the mothers that I see and I work with, I see burnout as such a symptom of patriarchal motherhood. But then I also see it as we kind of work to tweeze ourselves apart from and resist patriarchal motherhood. Mm-hmm. I see burnout there too, because it is so exhausting and requires such mental gymnastics and is lonely and isolating in its own way, because you are choosing to mother your children in more of a countercultural way, and you're choosing to just live your life in a countercultural way. So burnout seems to be prevalent no matter, you know, which hood you're within, either defying it or attempting to survive it.
You're absolutely right. And again, I've written on this in the book I mentioned, you know, the costs, you know, the gains, of course, of feminist mothering, but the costs. I mean, let's not kid ourselves. This is hard work. We're doing this with not just no support. We're doing this with often much resistance.
Yes.
Society does not want strong women. It does not want empowered mothers. Of course it doesn't, because then we're going to change the world, right? Mm-hmm. They want to keep us tired and burnt out and self-doubting and guilty and competitive with one another. This is all a plan. And so I think, you know, it's really hard to resist, because you, particularly with motherhood, because if you resist, well, I could say a couple things on this. Resistance is also very often only privileged women, because if you're at all marginalized by age or race or class, your resistance could result in the apprehension of your children.
Absolutely.
You know, so I'm not saying don't resist, but it can be very dangerous for someone to resist because of racism and classism and homophobia and transphobia. So certain mothers might want to resist, but they can't, or they resist very strategically because they know outright resistance could harm them and their children. So we all struggle with this. Doing feminism is hard in a patriarchal culture. I think feminist mothering in a patriarchal culture is even harder. I'm not saying don't do it, but that's why, which we talk about, I talk about my book, but talk about it at all our conferences. That's why it's absolutely essential, the work that you're doing, this conscious raising. You know, we did this, I shouldn't say we, I'm too young, but, you know, the history of feminism, this was the way women came to feminism, was conscious raising in the West in the 60s. And that's why I think that's the root for motherhood empowerment, with the work that you're doing. I think we need to go back to really old fashioned conscience raising. We need to bring mothers together in whatever format, book clubs, as you know, I'm doing a book club, or in the playground, or in the groups you run, or in virtual spaces. But the challenge that is, as I'm sure you've encountered, can women speak authentically about their mothering? Can we out ourselves? And most women I speak to are very, very apprehensive or reluctant to speak truth, to speak authentically. And for obvious reasons, you know, do they want to be seen as a bad mother? Do they want, you know, in some cases, as I said, that could be, you know, not just inconvenient, it could be outright dangerous. But, you know, so many women I talk to say they go to those mommy groups and they're just really hoping to find community and candor and connection. And it doesn't happen, because they're all what Susan Moshart calls the mask of motherhood. And I just love that term. It's very dated, but it just works. We all wear this mask. Everything's great. Love my kids. Everything's perfect. You know, I'm happy. Maybe are sometimes, but we can't unmask ourselves. We can't, you know, say, I'm having a really bad day right now. I really don't like being a mother right now. My kids are driving me crazy. Did I make a mistake becoming a mother? You can't say those things in most mommy groups. So women need those spaces where they're, first of all, really, really safe without judgment. And that they, you know, so some women find with close friendships. I was fortunate that I did find it when I was raising my children. We found it in the playground, right? Most of them were single moms. I was the only partnered one, I believe. And there was maybe 12 of us, 15 of us. We had no money. And we'd sit in the playground and just bitch, right? With our kids playing, we'd all other mother make sure your kid didn't, you know, break their nose climbing that swing. And we really raised our children among the community in graduate housing. And I wasn't perfect, you know, but overall we could do it without judgment and censor. And women need those spaces so desperately. But it's really hard to find them in a patriarchal culture because we're so competitive and so judgmental. So the challenge is, where do we create those spaces where women can safely unmask, authentically share their experiences, and get support, validation, and community and maybe some good old fashioned advice, not judgment, right? But to say, you know what, my kid did that too. And, you know, this is what I suggest. Not saying it's going to work for you, not to be prescriptive, but just create those places where you can really rant and understand that it's not about you. It's about the larger culture, as you keep saying, and you're so right. But we keep seeing as an individualized problem.
Yes.
If I just try harder, I'll be a better mother. If I just buy this product, I'll be a better mother. If I just enroll my kid in this program, I'll be a better mother. You know, so we need to get mad. We need to get really mad. And we need to say, this is not right. And, you know, and this needs to change. And we need to come together and speak truthfully about why it's not working and how we can undo it, change it, or at the very least, you know, hold each other's hand while we go as we experience this with comfort and concern and care and respect.
That's it. I feel that so deeply in my bones. And I love also the concept of the mask of motherhood.
Yes.
And I use it so often in my work too, because I think it is so relevant. It's scary to take our masks off as mothers, like you said. And, you know, through what I've been reading and the research that's available, I've seen how so many of these well-intended mom groups, whether they're virtual or in person, tend to recreate patriarchal normative standards and values in their small subgroup, right? So even when we come as mothers into these places where we are invited and hopeful that maybe this will be a space of vulnerability and, you know, safety and trust where I can take off my mask, we come into it and it stays and remains so superficial because we are so scared of bearing our truest, most authentic selves.
Yes, we are. And we know why we're scared, because we know the repercussions, perhaps.
Yeah. Yep.
Who wants to be that person? You won't be invited back to the party, right? You know, or worse, you know, those, you know, I mean, I've known stories, actual stories where women has outed herself and, you know, social service has been called. It's not.
Yes.
It's not just a metaphor. So, I mean, white privileged women, probably that's not going to happen. But still, do you want to admit, you don't want to admit to yourself that you're having a bad day. Do you want to admit that to somebody else? Mm-hmm. We're supposed to have it together. We're supposed to be happy in all of this. This is supposed to be what we wanted. How dare we complain? Right. We have a perfect life. Right. Yeah. If you do, you know, if you're, you know, white, middle class and able bodied and relatively good health and have your desired child, well, what's wrong with you? Yeah. Right. So I think women don't have the permission, the authority to speak their truth. Or they don't have, what you say, like this, it's more than safety, like the trust that they know that what they say will be honored, but also taken in a way that isn't punitive. I'm struggling with the language, but we kind of know that, right? We kind of feel it, right? Yeah. When we know we're in those safe spaces. So I'm creating with your groups. I mean, I think I try to do it in my classrooms. In my book, I talk about a fabulous organization, which has since closed. I have a great chapter, if I may brag, on the National Association of Mother Centers. And they ran from the 70s until about 3 years ago. And they called them Mother Circles. And at one point, they had over 100 of them over the U.S. And, you know, then they were down to 20, 30. Anyway, they're now officially closed. But I did a major research project on them, and I went to their groups and I interviewed the moms. I interviewed the leaders, the creators. And oh, my God, one woman, they all said, this saved my life. They literally said, if I wasn't going to this mother's circle, I don't know what would have happened. And it's all what we're talking about, that validation, that community, that authenticity. And that absolutely begins with a place of non-judgment and confidentiality. So we need to create those spaces again. They're probably going to be virtual, I think, in our new world, unfortunately. I think they're better in person. But the reality is that we need to create these spaces. And I'm hoping to do it with the book clubs I'm creating, because I also didn't say, which is probably the most important thing about me, my PhD is in English. And most of my writing is actually on women's narrative. I'm actually writing a monograph right now on mothering in post-210 women's fiction. And I've read a lot, but I've written on 29 novels in 13 chapters, and I've got another 6 or 7 planned. And I think it's often in literature that we go and find what we need, right? Those stories. not only repression, but resistance. Yep. So I really think book clubs, not just the one I'm hoping to put forward, but I think they're really subversive places, right? That women can use literature as a way into critique and to rant and debate.
I love that.
Through a character, right? Mm-hmm. And there's so many books out there. Oh my goodness. In the, my book, I have a appendix where I list all the books I've written on. And my goodness, they're just everywhere. And I just think women start reading these books, that the aha moment will happen. Mm-hmm. They're like, oh my goodness, I'm not alone.
Yes.
You know, through a woman character. So it's kind of safe doing it through literature in a way, because it's fiction, right? But boy, fiction can tell us a lot about truth, right? So anyway, that's another place. I think group classes, book clubs, online groups, discussion groups, even at reading in your own home, places where you can meet other like-minded mothers. They might be fictional, but boy, a lot of fictional mothers saved my life, right? When I was reading. So I think I know mothers are busy. We're busier than anybody, but in the time you must claim for yourself, pick up a good feminine, it doesn't even have to be feminine, but pick up a novel about motherhood that critiques mothering. I think it will go a long way in empowering that individual mother, and or at least reassuring her.
I love that so much, because just in the times that you and I have talked, I agree. I see it as an avenue of kind of like sneaking your way into this space that feels safer at first. It doesn't feel like, whoa, I'm taking this on. This is really big and heavy work. It's more this opportunity to see yourself reflected, you know, the parts of you, more of that shadow side that we mask up so tightly, but that then become more accessible through this literature. It's definitely fantastic avenue.
It's so true. And that's why, you know, I am using literature to better understand patriarchal motherhood, where it comes from, how it works, you know, what it does to mothers negatively, how the mothers deal with it, how do they resist it. And I think we can ask those questions in a way through fiction that is just, I don't know, easier or quicker. For example, the book club that we have novels about mothers who lead. Whoa. I mean, we're learning a lot about what's wrong with patriarchal motherhood by these mothers who just, I don't know if you've read, you know, Nora Ibsen's classic, The Doll's House, when Nora, you know, walks out and slams the door. What brings a woman to that? You know, how can we change or think about changes needed to motherhood by women who have just had enough, right? Who walk away. I mean, you know, won't give away the plots, but that's often more as a metaphor, like these women leaving is, you know, pulling the mask away from motherhood and exposing what is wrong with it and what drives women to leave. It is a formidable critique of all the many ways that patriarchal motherhood is not working. And so I think from mothers leaving, we can learn what's wrong and correct it maybe by not leaving, if you will, right? I mean, what mothers are leaving happens, but it's also a metaphor, I think, that we need to learn. They're leaving is shining a glaring light on what's wrong.
Yep. Yep, absolutely.
And fiction, which is really enjoyable to read, right? It isn't heavy theoretical work, which sometimes, you know, makes you nod off. That's the thing about fiction. It's always good, right? It's always enjoyable. It's always a page turner. You know, it's not like reading dense theory, but I think you get to the same truths. But I think in a more lively, engaging, empathetic way. That's my bias towards literature, but then I have a PhD in English. So, you know, I think we learn from stories. And, you know, we live by, you know, stories are how we define ourselves, and so much so, more than what I think we realize. So anyway, that's my plug for book clubs, for literature, to use literature as a way to interrogate patriarchal motherhood and have a really good time doing so, particularly in a book club, because then you can rant, but have a focus for that rant, and you can learn and rant at the same time.
Yeah, it's almost like the invitation is there to rant. Like if you bring moms together and say, this is the purpose of why we're coming together, right? It's mm-hmm. We're almost saying the invitation is there to take off your mask. In fact, we'd want you to take off your mask and go there. Go to these darker, heavier places as you feel safe and comfortable to do so. But it's almost saying like, to heck with tiptoeing into the water. Let's just jump. Let's just go for it. And really embrace for our own empowerment and kind of liberation of all mothers, what it means to be a mother within patriarchal normative motherhood.
That's right. You're so true, because often you can't see it in your own life. We can't. And sometimes when you're reading a novel or even a sociological study, but you can say, oh my God, that's not right. That's wrong. Why is the husband not doing more? No wonder she's tired. No wonder she's pissed off. You know, well, But we often can't see that in our own lives. We can, but we don't validate it in the same mm-hmm. way. But we see it in someone else's life, also in film or fiction. We can sit up and go, well, no, that's not right. You know, where did that come from? Why is that happening? How can we do something about that? So it's this consciousness raising through literature that I think it is a place to begin, not a place to stay necessarily. There's other ways to do it, obviously. The Mother's Circle had a thing called the talking stick, is it? Where women would walk around and there would be a prompt and the woman would have to, you know, and, you know, share with the talking circle, almost continue another woman's observations, if you will. So there's lots of strategies to unmask, to interrogate patriarchal motherhood, to better understand it. But the purpose of all this is to better understand it, to change it.
That's it. That is absolutely it. So I'm aware of the time and I'm like, well, how are we going to do this? I have 1800 more questions to ask you. So we'll have to do a round two, maybe even a round three.
Okay. But
I'm wondering, I don't know where to go next in our limited time. What feels most pertinent to you? Should we dabble into matricentric feminism or?
Yeah, I think that's a good one. I realize we haven't even talked about that.
I know.
Oh dear. Okay. Matricentric feminism. Oh my God. So matricentric again, because I'm an academic and literary, I guess we come up with these really unwieldy terms, but it's matricentric, which means matri means mother and centric means center, right? So it's just an academic word for a mother-focused feminism, mother-centered feminism. I call it matricentric feminism. And it's a, you know, I coined the term, I started using the term, you know, 2010, 2012, but in 2016, I wrote a book on matricentric feminism. And the second edition came out in 21. So I sort of say 2016 is when I coined the term, though I was using it before that. And yet again, the book I mentioned, I talk a lot about matricentric feminism. I also have done a whole book on it. But basically, you know, I just begin with, I think, the obvious. We need a feminism that puts mothers at its center. In many ways, mainstream feminism has failed mothers. I'm not saying intentionally. I'm not saying that. But liberal feminism or even socialist feminism or mainstream feminism has not put mothers at its center. Mothers are not just, you know, women are not just women, they're mothers. We need what in academic we call intersectional. We need to understand that many things we experience of mothers, socially, economically, culturally, psychologically, economically, are because of us as mothers, not just because we're women. So I think, I mean, it seems so self-evident to me that we have different needs and concerns, both as we are oppressed as women, but also how we can potentially resist as women. So I use the term mother women. So the concerns of mothers can be different than the concerns of women. So matricentric feminism isn't the only feminism. It's just a feminism I think we need for mothers that may complement other feminisms. So it's about putting mothers first. So in my book, I don't have it handy, but I list sort of the principles of it. You know, it must be, you know, mother-centered. It must be, you know, value the work of mothering. It must recognize that while it's valuable, it's not just women that should do this important, necessary work. We must think about, you know, mothering is something we all should do, not limited to gender. So it's, you know, and I basically believe that, you know, despite 50 years of feminism now, I don't think mothers are doing much better. I think they're doing worse.
Yeah.
So, you know, what would a matricentric feminism look like? I have a book coming out in September that's just on matricentric feminism. It's, you know, I'll do a brag on this one because it isn't just me. It's 24 articles from around the world about how women are using that and some men are using matricentric feminism of everything from public policy to film to literature to educational policy. What happens when we put mothers at the center? What happens when we think about mothers first? How would that change the way we see education, public policy, healthcare? So it's about seeing the world through a mother lens. And understanding that mothers have needs that are different from women's needs. So it's not saying all, you know, that mothers, it's not all that matters. When I'm just saying, if you're a mother, nothing else matters. It's just for most women, I think mother is a big part of their life. And some women said that mother more than gender, in fact, may determine, maybe matter more to them. They feel they're oppressed more as a mother than they're oppressed as a woman. That's a lot I've just said, but it is a mother-centered feminism. It's a feminism that puts at its heart social change specifically for mothers.
And this is why I consider myself a matricentric feminist psychotherapist.
Yes. This is why. Thank you. And we need that. We so need this mother-centeredness, particularly in your discipline. There is no more discipline that is mother-blaming or child-centered than psychology. It might as well be the 1950s in psychology. It is the last French. I hate to use that metaphor, but it really, we have seen little movement in psychology, you know, and I would say in English studies, film studies, sociology, anthropology, we have seen more and more, you know, mother-centered, matricentric feminism happening. So psychology is the last patriarchal holdout. It's still so mother blaming and child centered. So you're right.
That.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yes.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
No, we just need that. And we need to understand it politically. Psychology is also the most apolitical discipline there is, right? Maybe that's not fair, but I think it is. It's very apolitical.
No, I think that I see that in my work and in my trainings too. We just continue to say it really takes on this, like, what's wrong with you, mom? Why aren't you adjusting more quickly to this? Yep. Or why are you struggling with burnout? You should take more time for yourself, right? We'll prescribe more self-care without providing you the resources to do it. Or, exactly. You know, what's up with this mom rage? Where's this coming from? Like, good moms don't get angry. I still feel like that narrative is so strong. That's the leading narrative in so many clinical spaces. I think we just further pathologize motherhood. And so really incorporating the theory of matrescence as one way, and then the theories, more broadly of motherhood studies, but specifically of matricentric feminism, I think really can revolutionize the way that we support mothers clinically and really empower them instead of further blaming them for their experience of motherhood.
Yes. And that's the apolitical. There's, you know, the world's fine, mom. There's just something wrong with you. Right.
Yeah.
And the other, of course, piece is that everything that is wrong in the world is mother's fault anyway. Right. So Paula Kaplan, who has since passed away, wrote probably one of the most important books that I, you know, certainly write on, Don't Blame Mother. And she was from the discipline of psychology, a Canadian scholar. Don't Blame Mother is sort of the must read, very lay person book. And she just, you know, mothers are blamed from everything. You know, she said from athlete's foot to autism, and she's right. You know, so I think we blame mothers, we judge mothers, we depoliticize the work of mothering, we individualize it. And of course we do, because it's so easy to have a scapegoat. It's so easy to say it's all mother's fault, because then we don't have to bring around social change. So if child is, you know, not doing well at school, well, maybe we need better educational policy. Oh, no, we don't. It's just the mother, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. or, you know, a child, you know, is ill. Well, the mother didn't feed that child well. Well, maybe because we have something called poverty in the United States. Mm-hmm. So we can just, you know, use the mother as a scapegoat for all social ills. Then we don't have to look at those social ills and change those social ills. Yep. So it just works in so many complex ways, the figure of the mother. You know, and that's why, you know, we keep returning to why it has to be studied. So I hope I answered matricentric feminism. That was just a big, but it's not as complex as it sounds. It is just a feminism that says mothers matter. And we're going to think about how to empower mothers. And we're going to do that by listening to mothers and focusing on their needs. And we're going to build a feminism based on all of that.
Well, it absolutely changed my life personally and professionally when I came across that theory. So again, I am just really grateful, because it's a whole other way of for mothers to be able to view their experience. And also, I think truly to look for other providers that take this orientation to their work as well, so that they can gain support that no longer contributes or further pathologizes their experience.
Yes. And I think it is happening again, far too slowly and incrementally, but I am seeing that language. So anyway, we have one time for maybe one more question or reflection or conversation.
Oh my gosh. I have so many more. But as we close up this episode, I'm wondering, if you look three generations into the future, what would be your hope?
Gosh, you know, I'm actually starting a research project, which has been delayed, on millennial mothers, maybe Gen Z mothers. I'm going to interview them. And so, you know, millennial mothers are, you know, I think having children, and Gen Zs are starting to think about it. I think we need to ask those questions, because I think mothering is fundamentally different than it was when I had my children 40 years ago. I mean, of course, stays the same. We still have the patriarchal institution. Motherhood is still devalued. Mother's still, you know, mother in isolation and judgment and blah, blah. We've talked about all that. But I think what mothers you know, we are living in such an uncertain world right now, right? You know, we talk about climate change. We talk about, you know, the rise of AI. We talk about increasing, you know, economic, you know, precarity. We talk about the crisis of, you know, migration. So yes, but I do think all of them impact the way mothers are mothering today. But if I could imagine a world, I think we had that world. I think we had it in other times and other cultures. I don't think we have to look too far. Mm-hmm. We have templates. And I write about this in my book, Indigenous cultures, pre-contact in the US and Canada, other cultures before the rise of patriarchy. So we're going back, you know, 6,000 years, but there's a lot of literature now there. Cultures that value mother work, that see mothering as work. Imagine that concept, that mothers are active participants in all decision-making, that we don't have this either or, you can be a mother or a worker. We have to see mothering as, you know, inclusive of all. To this day, I do not understand why we assume mothers have to not work. That doesn't make any sense. I mean, of course, we have to have public policy to support that, but many cultures understood that mothers were providers and nurturers. There wasn't this either or, should I work or stay home? That was nonsensical. Mothers worked and raised their children. Of course, you need a world to make that possible, but it is possible through extended kin, through community mothering, through, you know, good, decent childcare, through, you know, perhaps longer leaves when mothers want to focus on their mothering. There's times that maybe you don't want to be working. So make that possible. Maybe in the early years, no, that is going to be your focus mothering. But maybe when they're three, you're like, I'm getting itchy. I want to go out there again. So let's create a world where you can do both. We never ask that of men. And I think, you know, I did an interview and I was so angry because the end of the interview, can mothers have it all or can women have it all? Or, you know, and I said, would you ever ask that of men? Would you ever say to men, can you have it all? That's so insulting. Yes, women can have it all, but we have to change the world for that to happen. Yeah. Right. And why do we have these sacrifices of only women? Why do we say to mothers, oh, you have to choose between career and home? You have to give up yourself to be a good parent. We don't ask them if fathers. So I believe, I always say to mothers, be a bit more selfish, be a bit more self-centered, because I think the more confident women are, the more resources they have, the more community they have. Of course, that's going to make them better mothers and happier people. So what that world would look like, you know, gosh, I think it would be a radical revolution. We'd have to really do away with how we, I'm not saying we have to do away with nuclear family, but we have to really expand the boundaries of family and, you know, have more fluidity and really do away with gender roles. We have to do away with gender. There's nothing that says a father cannot change his nappy, that a father cannot comfort a child after, you know, when the child comes home upset from school. There is nothing innate about mothering. It's all learned. I mean, I'm not, of course, we give birth if we are, you know, birth mothers, but mothering is like saying all my work is a verb. It's an activity that anyone can do and that everyone should do and that should be supported by society.
Yep.
Full-heartedly. So I imagine a world where we see as mothering as a shared occupation that all of us partake in and we value all our society's children and we put our world's resources to supporting parents, both parents, who do the work in a true partnership that's also then supported and sustained by the larger community's commitment to that family and to the larger, you know, the larger cultural aim of, you know, raising good and happy children, all children, not just some children.
That's exactly all that. So that part, all children, right? I think there's a proverb my mom once told me, and I unfortunately don't know who to give credit to, but it says, when you become a mother to one children, you become a mother to the world's children. And that's so
we've forgotten that.
Yep.
Particularly in our competitive, and I understand why we have competitive mothering. You know, there's only so many spots in that good school. There's only so many, you know, we think we have to put another child down to put our child up. That's that Western individualized competitiveness. Yep. And we don't need to do that. We can do it another way. And other societies have done it other ways. And we did it other ways for thousands of years before the rise of what we considered modernity and patriarchy 200 years ago. So there are other ways of doing family and doing motherhood that I think are healthy. And the other thing I want to end with, patriarchal motherhood is not just bad for mothers. It's bad for children. Mm-hmm. It's not healthy to raise our children this way. It is not. And if we want to raise healthy children, we have to, you know, support mothers. That is just so obvious, but we don't.
Yeah.
So I think that's where we begin, is understanding that, you know, what we know is common sense must be, you know, made into every imaginable space in culture, public policy, and education. We need, you know, mothers, the work of mothering needs to be valued, supported, and shared.
Oh, Dr. O'Reilly, you leave me feeling inspired, empowered, hopeful. You know, I think that when we talk about the impact of what it means to be a mother today and the impact of mothering within patriarchal motherhood, it can feel, you feel the oppression just talking about it, right? You feel the heaviness and the ick and almost the hopelessness of like, what's the point? How can I continue to resist and defy? It's so heavy. It's so intense. But in hearing you share, right, that we don't have to recreate the wheel. We can learn from one another. We can be vulnerable with each other and with one another and indeed be the change, right? Sounds so cliche, but mothers are the change that we need to see in this world. And we will have to fight for it. And it will be exhausting and difficult. But it's necessary. And it really is only going to come from us.
That's right. So I have to say to mothers, you know, resist, 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 but create community, community, community in that resistance and create those spaces for truth and candor and empowerment and community. Join a book club, create a book club, create an online. I'll end with this. We used to have a great organization called the Mother Outlaws because Adrienne Rich once said, you have to be outlaws in the institution of motherhood. We even had t-shirts that said Mother Outlaws.
I have t-shirts that say that.
So we need to create a Mother Outlaw, you know, counter revolution. And we got to create it, and we got to reach out to other mothers. We got to, you know, and we have to show kindness and support. And when we're in the public world, we have to stop judging mothers. We have to stop judging ourselves. And we really need I know it's a cliche, but we really need to get together here, mothers, and we need to create that space that we honor and respect and support each other. And then together, we go like this, and then we go like this.
Yes.
And we use our community power to push back. But we need to do this first, I think, mm-hmm. to really join of each other. So your groups are doing that. I hope my books do that. Mm-hmm. I hope my teaching does that. I hope my book clubs do that. I hope my interviews do that. I'm just really hoping to create a space that undoes normative motherhood or patriarchal motherhood, gets rid of its power so we can find our own power in motherhood that patriarchy, of course, takes away from us. Because the last thing patriarchy wants is strong and empowered mothers. Because you know what? We will change the world.
Mm-hmm.
So I always say, claim your power, mothers, push back. And I'm hoping in that we can at least have some change in our lifetime and certainly hopefully more change for our children's lifetime.
Oh my goodness. This conversation was so rich. There's just so much here, so much to like, I hope that moms, you know, repeat, listen again and again and again, because there's so many nuggets of wisdom and power that you have shared with us today. I am so profoundly grateful for what you have created, the field of motherhood studies, the discipline, the theories within maternal theory, and I'm losing all my words right now, but just so profoundly grateful to you. And I hope I'm lucky enough to have you on again, because there's so much more here.
We have last shout out, as I said, at Rom Demeter Press. We're the first and still only feminist press on motherhood. We've published 200 books now on motherhood. Go to it's Demeter Press. Demeter actually was a feminist mother goddess from Greek times. She's the original outraged, pissed off mother that fights back. That's why we named our press in honor of her. Look at the books we've published, not just us, but that's a great place to start. There's a lot out there. We don't have to reinvent the wheel.
That's right.
There's a lot of research, scholarship, activism out there. So as I kept saying, create those spaces, read those books, join those book clubs, you know, wear your Mother Outlaw t-shirt, mm-hmm. Be kind to a woman in the airport when she's struggling with her child. Say, I've been there, anything I can do.
I love it. Well, thank you so much.
And we're over time. And until next time, Chelsea, it's been an absolute honor and delight. And thank you for all the work you're doing.
I feel so grateful, just so grateful. And I know it's 12, so you got to go, but thank you, thank you, thank you.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode of the Reimagining Motherhood podcast. I hope you gained a couple nuggets of wisdom, some new vocabulary, or an expanded perspective on motherhood from this episode. Make sure you check the show notes for further information on these topics and ways in which you can get involved or learn more if you choose. And if you enjoyed this episode, please leave a 5-star rating and better yet, a glowing review so that this material can reach many more mothers and we can continue to reimagine motherhood together. In the meantime, make sure to follow along on Instagram at Mama's Modern Village and head over to my website at www.mamasmodernvillage.com for groups, my professional training, and other offerings to support you in reimagining motherhood in real time. Again, thanks so much for listening, and I can't wait to bring you the next episode.